copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm a doctor. I trained as a general surgeon, and I currently work as the chief executive of the Christian Medical Fellowship in the UK, which is a group of 5,000 doctors and 1,000 medical students. And I think my interest in social justice began really when I was a junior doctor around the whole issue of abortion. And I was struck by the fact that so few evangelicals actually thought about this issue, less did anything about it. And I think that was the initial step for me. But at CMF at the moment, we do a lot of advocacy work. And in fact, part of the reason that I'm not that well at the moment is we've just come off 3 weeks of very serious campaigning from dawn to dusk around the issue of euthanasia, because we've had two huge threats in the UK. First of all, a court case threatening to change the law to legalize doctors being able to help people kill themselves, which had reached the Supreme Court, in which we intervened for 3 days, and the judgment is still awaited, a case called the Conway case. And then over the last 2 weeks, we've been fighting a move to legalize assisted suicide on the island of Guernsey, which is one of the Channel Islands between France and England, which resulted in a parliamentary vote just a few days ago by 24 to 14 to defeat that motion. But it's all been very wearing. But we have seen, over the last 12 years, we've seen 11 attempts now to legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide in Britain, all of which have failed through parliaments, which is why they're going to the small islands and to the courts now. So that's kind of the background of what I do. I first was inspired by Wilberforce when I was a student, but I think it was what really drew his life much more to my attention was John Piper. And John Piper has written a very useful little book called Amazing Grace, the Life of William Wilberforce, which goes into his theology and evangelical background. I'm not sure if it's available on the bookstore, but you can easily buy it on Amazon. And Piper makes reference to, I think, the most important book in terms of understanding Wilberforce is his view of practical religion, which I'll make reference to and is in your notes. And you can, again, pick that up on Amazon. Eric Metaxas, a lot of the pictures I've got come from this book. And then if I somehow don't get to the end of this talk, or even if you want something that will give you everything that we look at, then this little booklet of mine, The Christian Call to Social Justice, which is based on the life of Wilberforce but goes on to look at biblical principles of advocacy, is on the bookstore. It's only €1, I think, on the forum. So there's 100 of them, so there's plenty for everyone here and for friends as well. So I think a lot of people don't understand what really made Wilberforce tick. And if you go and watch the film Amazing Grace, then you will be inspired by his work that he's best known for, which was the abolishing of the slave trade back in the early 19th century. But it won't tell you, the film, a huge amount about his Christian beliefs, which undergirded all this. So let's just think about his life, first of all. He was born in 1759. That's a very important date. And he died in 1833 at the age of 73. Interestingly, I think he was married. He married quite late in his 30s, but he had 6 children. And I find that quite fascinating. and encouraging too. Six children didn't stop Wilberforce making a massive impact. And in fact, if you read his biography, you'll see that God used his family, and especially his children, and the reckless play he had with his children, to keep him sane and to keep him full of joy through all the battles that he faced. He just loved spending time with his children. And I think it's a great example to us as Christians involved in ministry, that actually God gives us our families not just to be responsible for, but actually to help build us up, our instruments of common grace in our lives, to strengthen us. And to really understand Wilberforce, we need to understand the time in which he lived. Because he was born just at the time that the evangelical revival was taking off in Great Britain, which was to have effects all over the world, not just in terms of social justice, but in spawning the world missionary movement, which began in the late 18th century and took Christianity to most of the countries of the world that had not yet been reached. And so at this time, there were two very important figures in Britain, John Wesley and George Whitefield. And they were preaching up and down the country and seeing thousands and thousands of people come to faith. They say that Whitefield was probably the greatest preacher the world has ever seen, and crossing the Atlantic several times during his lifetime. And he had something I envy at this moment, the most extraordinary, incredible voice that you could hear 10 blocks away, so that he could be in Washington, and you know, you could be down at where the Congress building is, and you could hear him at the White House. It was that kind of voice, absolutely phenomenal. One of the greatest actors at the time said that he would give a small fortune just to be able to say, oh, like George Whitefield could. And of course, in America, Whitefield met up with Jonathan Edwards, the famous American Congregationalist, who was, by God's enabling, the architect of the Great Awakening in New England. And this time of the mid-18th century, of course, led on to that very important date of 1792, which is when William Carey went with the Baptist Mission Society to India and became the first missionary to the developing world. And that was really what catalyzed the world mission movement. So out of this crucible of the late 18th century, much of what we now take for granted in world mission and in our Christian influence on the social fabric of countries came. Now, of course, it was shortly after the abolition of the slave trade started. But it was also during this period of 1760 through to 1800, of course, that the American Revolution took place, that the French Revolution took place, the launch, in effect, of the Enlightenment and all its influences. And explorers like Captain Cook were discovering countries like Australia and New Zealand, from where I come originally. So the whole world was changing in a quite extraordinary way. And as we're going to see, all the figures of this time, the people we know in the Christian world, all knew each other. And they worked together. And they had a profound influence on each other's faith and direction. And Wilberforce is perhaps, we would not have a Wilberforce if it wasn't for these other people. It was also, of course, the time of King George III, we call Mad King George, because he had a condition, we think, called porphyria, which caused mental illness and maybe contributed to some of the loss of the colonies that happened during his time. But it was right in the middle of this time that a young man called William Wilberforce in 1776, now the Americans here, that's a very important date, isn't it? But it was in 1776 that Wilberforce came at the age of 17 to St. John's college in Cambridge. People started university very early. Now, he'd been brought up in a nominal Christian family, but both his parents had died by the age of 9, and he was brought up by an aunt and uncle, William and Hannah Wilberforce, who were evangelical Christian believers who'd been very touched by the evangelical revival. And it was they who were very good friends of John Newton, the slave trader, who by this time was a pastor living in Olney, a village in central UK, in England. And they used to take the young William to John Newton's home. And it was here that he became aware of Wesley and Whitfield and got to hear them preach. But it didn't have any great effect on him, because actually when he came to Cambridge all those years ago in 1776, he was a hardened atheist, or at least a totally godless theist. He was upper class, he was very rich, and he was really a reprobate. He was into gambling and late night drinking. And shortly after arrival at Cambridge, he met and made friends with another person of very similar disposition called William Pitt. Now, you may have heard of William Pitt, because William Pitt later became Britain's youngest ever prime minister at the age of 24. Extraordinarily. Anyway, these two good friends, who had much more money than sense, decided more or less on a lark, let's run for Parliament. And so at the age of 21, and armed with £8,000, which was an absolute fortune in those days, William Wilberforce began a campaign and won the seat of Hull in northeast England and became an MP at 21 years old, at the same time as William Pitt. Now remember, 3 years later, William Pitt was Prime Minister. He never lost an election throughout his whole life, although he went in several different seats. But it's extraordinary sometimes the way that God works through the most human or perhaps even godless of ways, to put this wealthy young drunkard and gambler with a huge brain but no common sense into Parliament as a future ruler of the country. And such is God's providence. So all of this happened before any spiritual awakening in Wilberforce. And it was actually almost as a joke that a friend of his, who had been a previous tutor at Cambridge, a man called Isaac Milner, said to Wilberforce, let's go over to the French Riviera for a holiday. And so they did. And as reading material, they'd found this book with a very interesting title called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. Now, it was written by a man called Philip Doddridge. You might recognize that name, because Doddridge is a very famous hymn writer and had a very close association with our church in St. Albans in England, because he was a member there once, as was someone else very famous that we'll come to shortly. Anyway, later Milner was to become a mathematician, an inventor, the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, and Lucasian professor of mathematics, and along with Charles Simeon, another famous name, he would be the largely responsible for the evangelical revival at Cambridge, which followed. Now, through reading Doddridge's book, Wilberforce was very deeply moved, and this led initially in 1885 to, so he'd been an MP for 5 years at this point, got in 1785, to an intellectual conversion and a deep moral crisis. And it was later, as his faith began to grow, he came into a personal relationship with God, and he began to doubt his whole political vocation. So he wondered whether it was possible for a Bible-believing Christian to be a parliamentarian. And he was so exercised by this that he thought very seriously of leaving Parliament to become a preacher. And to seek advice, he went to none other than John Newton. Now, John Newton had now moved from Olney, which was in the centre of England, down to London, and he was the vicar at a church called St. Mary's Woolnoth. And Wilberforce didn't want anybody to know that he was seeing Newton. So he wrote him a secret letter, and then he arranged to meet him at his home, and he walked twice around the block so as not to create any, to throw people off the scent, in a sense, before he went in to meet Newton. Now, Newton, of course, was the slave trader who wrote the most famous ever hymn, Amazing Grace. And interestingly, he strongly advised Wilberforce not to leave Parliament. And it was just a couple of years later, this is in 1887, 88, that he met, or he had two very famous, very critical meetings in his life. And the first was that he met a man called Charles Clarkson. And Charles Clarkson was very deeply exercised about the slave trade. And he had written an essay for his university degree on the slave trade that he was about to publish. And this essay became the basis of Wilberforce's conversion to the whole issue. So it was a very scholarly and evidence-based piece that he met. And then the second meeting he had was with William Pitt, who we've mentioned already, who by this time was Prime Minister, and William Grenville, who was another MP at the time. And it was at William Pitt's home in Kent, in the southeast of England, that these three very wealthy Williams, Pitt, Wilberforce, and Grenville, they had a world-changing conversation sitting under an apple tree. And Pitt, of course, was only in his mid-20s. Grenville was going to become the Prime Minister after Pitt. So here you are, three of the most powerful men in the whole country, and very rich, one of whom's just become a Bible-believing Christian. But all of them were deeply concerned about the slave trade. But neither Grenville nor Pitt was in a position to do anything about it because they were too enmeshed with their political parties. It needed to be done by someone who was a backbencher, effectively, and was not affiliated to a political party. And so they said to William, you know, you're an independent MP, and unlike us, therefore you must be the one to take on this issue. So a conversation with Don John Newton following his conversion, meeting Charles Clarkson, who'd done all the academic work, and then the meeting with these two prime ministers, one present and one future. Now, let me just show you a few pictures. To me, I love these pictures. They really bring the whole thing to life. But this is Wilberforce, the first picture we have of him at just 11 years of age. So look at this little boy. His parents have died 2 years earlier. He's living with his aunt and uncle. And yet, as we know, the Lord has a plan for everybody, and every day of his life was written in God's book before any of them came to be. This is Mad King George, or George III, who was one of the longest ruling of Britain's monarchs. So, from the late 18th century into the 19th century. And he was initially very friendly towards Wilberforce, which I think is interesting. So he used to ask him, how are your Negroes, he used to say. It was when the back in those days. Later, they had a disagreement over the French War, and they fell out to some degree. But he wasn't hostile towards Wilberforce's work, which is interesting. This is George Whitefield, and you see he died in 1770. So this was 10 years before Wilberforce came, but he had an influence on him early on. This is John Wesley, and this is a sketch of him on his deathbed. And he wrote a letter to Wilberforce, John Wesley. This was just 3 days before Wesley died, so in 1791. So this was, as we'll learn, it was just 2 years after he'd begun his campaign in 1789. And he said these words: "Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you'll be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you?" So here we have Wilberforce. This is at the age of 29. So he's been in Parliament for 8 years. It is 1788. And the project has only just begun. And John Newton. So, and you've seen John Newton comes up in the film, of course, but as we've noted, author of the hymn Amazing Grace. And of course, Newton was a slave trader. He was converted when he got into a storm crossing the Atlantic, and God convicted him. He moved out of slave trading, later became a pastor, became acquainted with Wesley and Whitefield again, and then counseled Wilberforce to stay in politics, in his words, for the good of the nation. So, you know, we read about these people in history and their extraordinary lives and the way that God used them. But we often don't realize that they were, in effect, a band of brothers. You know, just like you and I are today, who were there to stir one another up to love good works. And we would never have had Wilberforce without William Pitt. We would never have had him without Isaac Milner, without John Newton. We would never have had a John Newton without a Wesley and a Whitefield, and so on, you see. And the way that God's aim always was to raise up a people, not individuals, who played an extraordinary role in each other's lives. And this is William Pitt the Younger. So just so as we said, Britain's youngest prime minister at 24, and later playing a part. So we think back in biblical times of Cyrus, don't we, who was instrumental in bringing the Jews back to the Promised Land. Although not a believer, William Pitt played a similar role. This is one of the very earliest photographs from the late 1700s, and you see Pitt here on his feet walking, and then this is Wilberforce just behind him in the second roll of Parliament. A slightly different place from where the House of Commons is today, but there you are. Now, many people only know Whitefield because of his fight against the slave trade, but in reality, it was in a diary note he made in 1787, he said before that God had set before him two great objects. And the first was the suppression of the slave trade, and the second one was the reformation of morals, or the reformation of manners. And he wasn't writing this as a moralist or someone who was purely concerned about ethics. In the book that he wrote around the time I've mentioned already, A Practical View of Christianity, he laid out his whole philosophy, and it went something are like this. So, first of all, he said, you have to forgive the archaic language to some degree, but it's important to understand it. He said there were four incredibly important things. There were peculiar doctrines, which led on to true affections, which led to moral transformation, which led on to political reformation. Now, let me translate for you. These peculiar doctrines, what were they? Well, they were the fundamental truths rediscovered by the Reformation and taught by the apostles, which motivated the Puritans. And I mean fundamental beliefs like the moral depravity of man, the reality of judgment, substitutionary atonement, justification by faith, regeneration and empowering by the Holy Spirit, and a holy godly life as evidence of this transformation. So this was the fundamental he came from. He never used the word Calvinist to describe himself, for various political reasons, I think. But as John Piper says, if you go through his book, A Practical View of Christianity, you won't find anything in it that contradicts Calvinism in any way. He had extraordinary belief in the sovereignty of God. Now, what he says is that these peculiar doctrines, once believed, lead to true affections. In other words, truth, once believed, changes the heart and the whole orientation of a person and gives them joy and a passion to obey. And these true affections, this change in the heart, leads on to a transformed moral life, a life of obedience to God, moral transformation of individuals. And the result of this moral transformation of individuals, ultimately, as morally transformed individuals, believing in these truths and having their hearts on fire, once they get into positions of responsibility and influence within society, will begin to change and shape society. So the final step of political reformation is as a result of people like Wilberforce getting into these positions. Now, if we look at Wilberforce's contribution over the years and the many things that he was involved in, we learn that he was one of the founding members of what's known as the Clapham sect. And the Clapham sect was a group of Christian businessmen and politicians, other professionals, pastors, ministers, who lived in Clapham Common. And one of the leaders, apart from Wilberforce, was a pastor by the name of John Venn, who was the vicar at the Clapham Church. And all of these people were committed to the same principles, and Wilberforce was just one of them. And they were engaged in the early part of the 19th century in Britain of transforming society across a whole range of areas. So they had a concern, for example, for chimney sweeps, about child labour, cruelty to animals, prison reform, the restriction of capital punishment. But a huge amount of Wilberforce's personal fortune, and he was an extraordinary philanthropist, went into the foundation of the Sunday school movement. So he recognized the importance of children's education. And if you know your history well, you'll know that Sunday school attendance in Britain peaked in the year 1860. Now that's a very interesting date. So it's around the time, of course, of the American Civil War, isn't it? It's 1 year after the publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species. And it's also the time of an English revival, which happened between 1850 59 and 1862, which completely changed the country. So at that time, 70% of all children, 7 out of 10 of all children in England went to Sunday school. And by the year 1900, it had fallen to 50%. But by the year 2000, it had fallen to 3%. And it said you can trace and follow the downward trajectory of British culture by the level of Sunday school attendance. Now, we talk a lot about mission fields today. People talk about the 10-40 window, of course, between 10 and 40 degrees north of the equator, where many of the unreached people groups in the world live. But there's another very critical mission field, the 4-14 window, which is children between the ages of 4 and 14, who are just one generation away from being the leaders in the church, who have an astounding capacity to learn the Christian faith and who need to be taught. And Wilberforce recognized this, and he was an extraordinary benefactor towards the Sunday school movement. But he also supported many church parishes, paid for ministers preaching the gospel. And in addition to that, he was committed to paying off people's debts. Now, Britain was full of debtors' prisons at that time, where people went. Charles Dickens' father was in prison for many years for being a debtor. That's where people went. And so he was a redeemer of indebted people. And he was also one of the founders of the Church Mission Society, which was one of the mission societies that came out of the Church of England. And this started in the last decade of the 18th century. But in the first 5 decades of the 19th century, from 1800 to 1850, this was when there was an absolute explosion of mission work all around the world to the so-called coastal missions, followed by the inland missions, which transformed much of Asia and Africa and so on. Now, it's come to the slave trade. We'll just look at a few of the influences. So, Hannah Moore, he had lots of supporters. This was a woman who was very involved in the literary world. They called her the most skilled versificatrix in the English language, called by her detractors the old bishop in petticoats for her religious writing. So it's very interesting, the women in Wilberforce's life. It's another one, Madame de Stael, who called Wilberforce the wittiest man in all England. He had an astounding singing voice, apparently, and was also extremely funny and had an amazing sense of humour. There's records of him in the Houses of Parliament just cracking up at other people's speeches and convulsing on the floor laughing. So we come to the slave trade, and he gave his first speech on slavery in 1789, and it was 2 years later that the first bill was tabled. And he spoke in this speech for 4 hours in Parliament, just continually, with making 12 points at great length and with great eloquence, but with extraordinary factual and evidential basis as well. So he was someone who was not just a very powerful orator with great passion, but he'd really done his homework in terms of the facts that he marshalled. And he lost the vote by 163 to 88. It's quite a big victory. And over the next 18 years, he just kept going and going and going and going. 11 more bills. Each of them knocked back, bill after bill, speech after speech. And then eventually, on the 25th of March in 1807, the Slave Trade Act was passed by an overwhelming majority of 283 to 16. And the Parliament all rose and clapped him. He said he fell with his head in his hands and just cried tears after 18 years of work. Now, this first bill did not make slavery illegal, but it made the trading of slaves illegal. And that meant that it just completely cut the legs off the slave trade in Britain. But more than that, it was the initial step that led on to the change in the laws about slavery all around the world. Of course, it was not until the 1850s and 60s that the law changed in the US. But Abraham Lincoln was profoundly influenced by Wilberforce, what he's done. And if we think back now, you know, to most people in the Western world now, the whole idea of slavery is absolutely anathema. And yet, at that time, people could not see the problem with it. And the extraordinary thing about Wilberforce is that he didn't just change the law, he changed the whole of society and also the way everybody thought about this issue for more than two centuries. Now, I know we have great challenges today with other forms of slavery, of human trafficking and so on, but not to the extent that the aristocracy and the institutions of society are committed in the way that they are to, or that they were to slavery at that time. And of course, the problem is that the success of the economy was tied up with slaves. And if you think back, you can think back in human history, for 5,000 years prior to Wilberforce, and all the great civilizations of the world, whether it was the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, whatever, all of these great civilizations were built off the back of slavery, all of them. But it wasn't until Wilberforce that 5,000 years were overturned, which is why people say that he's probably the greatest social reformer the world has ever seen, and why his life is so worth studying. So, as I said, some years before, John Newton, who was in many ways a mentor to him throughout his life, said that the Lord has raised you up for the good of the church and for the good of society. And I think the challenge to us is that, in the same way, I believe that the Lord has raised and is raising up people in this generation, at this critical time of history, for the good of the church and for the good of society. And whether you are involved in government or in media or law, the professions, the performing arts or whatever, today's Clapham sect, I'd suggest, is our vision. Now, there is nothing new about social concern. We know that many of the great leaders throughout church history, from the church fathers to the first four centuries, to people like John Newton, John Owen, Jonathan Edwards, Wesley and others, all of them had this vision. But, of course, a concern for social action and work within societal structures goes right back to Scripture itself. Now, this is Wilberforce. At the age of 51, so this is 3 years after the Slave Trade Act went through, you can see his head is bent over slightly, and in fact he suffered from a curvature of the spine, which got worse and worse and worse until he had eventually died just 3 days before the passing of the Abolition of Slavery Act in 1833. I mentioned the famous people from our church. This is the other one. I don't know if you've heard of William Cowper. People regard him as a very famous hymn writer. He was known as the greatest poet of the evangelical revival. And he was converted actually in our church in St. Albans. And the story is quite extraordinary because he suffered terrible bouts of depression, and it was during one of those that a man who was at the time a member of our church and a doctor working with mental health led him to faith through verses that he left around this hospital in which he was staying, just over the road from our current church. And later, we only know about William Cowper because he was befriended by none other than John Newton, and they wrote a book of hymns together. But Cooper was also involved in writing poetry to support Wilberforce, so another really interesting link between them. Although this was long before really even photography or of course the internet or modern telecommunications, the pictures played a huge part in the campaign. This was a terrible incident in which 132 slaves were legally thrown overboard and drowned. And you know, the picture of this was something that was used all around Britain to horrify people and bring them to their senses. Similarly, this comes from a tract showing a sketch of the way that slaves were housed in ships. And this little image, they say the image that stopped 1,000 ships, if you can read the words, but it says, am I not a man and a brother? So from John Wedgwood, and they made this into cufflinks and hatpins and bracelets and tracts and so on. The humanity of all men. So let's look back at the scriptures, and we don't have to look very far in the Old Testament to find striking examples of people who served in secular or polytheistic states at very high level. So men and women of God who had a phenomenal influence on the society in which they lived, but within the political structures of that. So of course we have Joseph, who was effectively number two in Egypt, Nehemiah, a cupbearer, which is a senior government minister to the king of Persia, to Esther, of course, who married the king of Persia, Mordecai, who got her into that position of influence and encouraged her. And then, of course, there's Daniel and his friends who served in Babylon. And Babylon is a major theme throughout Scripture, very much in the New Testament as well, in the books of 1 Peter and Revelation, of course. And we see that we are living today in a state that is in many ways hostile to the Christian faith and to Christian truth. And of course these Jewish people did as well. And yet they were able to have a phenomenal influence. And I'd suggest that there were two things that they took to heart. You might remember, first of all, I think the story of the fiery furnace is very instrumental here, but remember, Daniel's three friends are told to bow down to the image. They're put in the fiery furnace, and in the middle of that chapter 3, they say, throw us into your fiery furnace. God will probably save us. But even if he does not, there's no way we're going to bow down to your image. Now, these people were not revolutionaries. They were serving the society. They had very senior positions in government. But there was a line they would not cross. And they were prepared at cost of their own lives to be morally distinctive. But they weren't unengaged. And I think it's interesting, you know, we talk about contemporaries and how much they influence each other. But the interplay between people in the Old Testament, who you might think didn't have an effect on each other, but Jeremiah and Daniel, take those. And of course it was, we learned from Daniel chapter 9, I think it is, Daniel says, I understood from the prophet Jeremiah that the captivity would last 70 years. And so I turned my face to the wall and began praying for their return to Jerusalem. So very interesting, isn't it? Jeremiah and Daniel having an influence on on each other. And Jeremiah, of course, wrote to the exiles in Babylon, and this very famous passage, and we often quote Jeremiah 29, 11, you know, for I have plans for you, a future and a hope, but we lift it out of context. The context is extremely important, because what he was saying to them is this. In Jeremiah 29, 4 to 9, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give them your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase the number there. Do not decrease also. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you in exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. This is what the Lord Almighty said. Now, I think it's very interesting. There they were living in Babylon. They were morally distinctive, but they were not unengaged. They didn't retire to the monasteries to safeguard their Jewish heritage. They got absolutely involved at every level of society and prayed for the good even in that pagan society and had an extraordinary role in shaping it. And you see, it's in that context that he goes on to say, for I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, to give you a hope and a future. You know, and you'll call to me and seek me when you find me with all your heart. This is the danger when we lift verses out of context and we don't look at the historical context in which they were raised. So they were exiles, but they were called to be both distinctive but also to be engaged in this society. Now, in the same way, Babylon is used to describe the situation in which we live today. We look forward to the new Jerusalem, to the new heaven and the new earth, but in the meantime we're called to be engaged in the same way, to build houses, to plant gardens, to have sons and daughters, and seek the peace and prosperity of the country in which we live. And the reason the Jews were asked to do this was because God is the Lord not just of Israel, but of every nation. And like these Jews, Wilberforce appreciated the sovereignty of God. He knew that the British government, his friend William Pitt as Prime Minister, would one day have to stand before the throne of Christ and face judgment. He knew that God raised up kingdoms and brought them down, and that he was the author of the rise and fall of nations throughout history. And that just as he'd raised the Greeks, the Assyrians, and the Egyptians, and the Babylonians, so also he would raise the British Empire and bring it down, which I think we've observed and we're still observing at the moment. Although as an immigrant to Britain, I can say this perhaps, as most Brits don't even realize, but if you look back over the last decades, you see the downward trajectory and the loss of the empire. And I think we can see a similar thing happening to America at the moment. It's reached its peak. And so he realized the sovereignty of God over the rise and fall of nations. And because it's God's world, this is why we're called to be subject to the governing authorities, but not to disobey God in the process of doing so. And of course, it's not blind obedience, because when the governing authorities that we live under call us to do things which God strictly commands we should not do, then we must conscientiously object, as Daniel and his three friends did. Of course, it meant the fiery furnace and the lion's den for them. It may mean similar kinds of loss for us, of reputation or of employment or of favor or perhaps even freedom. And the scriptures are full of stories of people who were loyal citizens and yet who drew a line at a certain point. And think of Rahab, the harlot, refusing to bow to the king of Jericho by handing over the spies. Think of the Israelite midwives at the time of Moses, who refused to hand over the Hebrew babies or kill them. Think of Daniel and his friends, think of the apostles who said, we obey God, not men, when they were commanded to stop preaching. So we march to a different drum. But the Bible is full of exhortations to social justice. I've just listed some of them there, and we go into much more detail in the booklet. But Amos 5:15, seek good, not evil, hate evil, love God, and interestingly, seek justice in the courts. So exactly what we were attempting to do just 3 weeks ago in Britain, seeking justice in the courts. Or Micah 6:8, act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. It was God who says in the book of Proverbs, speak up for those who have no voice, who cannot speak for themselves. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. And we know when the word poor is used in Scripture, it applies not just to those who don't have money, but anyone who's disempowered or marginalized or who does not have advocates. Proverbs 29:7, the righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. You see, it's a mark of God's people to walk with concern for God's justice. Or Proverbs 24:11, rescue those being carried away to death, those staggering towards slaughter. The Nazareth Manifesto, which was Jesus' own explanation of his own mission. You know, the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. So it goes on. We see the four elements of that are preaching, healing, deliverance, and justice. The announcement of the acceptable year of the Lord. So there we have the life of Wilberforce and the biblical basis. And I just want to finish by looking at a few objections, because I think that these truths that we've looked at today, which Wilberforce had an extraordinary grasp of, are not well grasped in the church at the moment. And I think for me, in my own walk in these areas of advocacy, I've been struck by two things. The first is that many of the greatest advocates for those who have no voice, whether it's, you know, unborn children, people with dementia, the poor, trafficked women, or whatever, you know, you can think of all the groups, are not evangelical Christians. In fact, in many ways, it is Catholic voices that put us to shame in this area. But in addition to that, these areas of advocacy are very lonely places for evangelicals, not just because there are so few evangelicals involved, but because many churches are actively preaching against it. I just want to go very quickly through some of these objections, and then we'll see how we go for questions. So there are those, first of all, who say that justice is the role of government. And that is, of course, true. Although many governments do not faithfully execute justice. And in a democracy like those that most of us live in, we are all rulers. We're all responsible at the ballot box. We all have influence. We can all do something. And I would suggest also that on the day of judgment, we'll all have to give account to God for the direction of the societies in which we live. It is one of the hardest things we find in Britain, in the causes that we work on at parliamentary level, is how few Christians there are. And how few of those Christians are actually involved in the really tough issues which cost something. And those that are, invariably, unlike Wilberforce, or at least unlike Pitt and Grenville, are not on the front benches in positions of power and cabinet. They're on the back benches like Wilberforce was. And yet a few of them are playing a huge part. Then there are those who say, well, the church's real work is evangelism. And of course, the church's work is evangelism, proclaiming the gospel. And I think it's fascinating to see, as I've shown you already, how involved Wilberforce was in evangelism and in funding mission. But of course, the Great Commission is from Jesus himself, was to go and make disciples, Matthew 28:19-20, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded you. And the Great Commission is not just about evangelism, it's about discipleship. And it's about growing to full maturity and knowing the Lordship of Christ in every area of our lives, be it in our family life, our church life, but in our work life and in our public life as well. And John Newton had the sense to recognize that the working out of Wilberforce's discipleship was to be salt and light in the place God had placed him. You know, there are others who say Christians shouldn't get involved in politics. Of course, some people were saying this to Wilberforce. He was wondering this himself. But we follow a God who sets up kings and queens and governors and who brings them down and who's deeply concerned about justice and who asks us to pray for and to be subject to governing authorities. There are those who say, well, you know, it's a pluralist society. There are many voices. What can Christians, you know, possibly do? But Rome and Greece were pluralist societies. It didn't stop the early church being involved to the extent that they say in the 4th century, the time of Constantine, 10% of all Romans were Christian believers. 10%. And in fact, there were enough Christian believers amongst the aristocracy, including, of course, Constantine's mother, who became almost an apostle for Christianity in the 4th century, that it completely turned the direction. There was a tipping point in the whole empire. And as Rome collapsed, Christianity, of course, went on. And Wilberforce also, of course, was in a society where the great majority of people didn't believe him. There are those people who say, well, yes, laws are important, but laws won't change people's hearts. And of course, we know that, but laws do restrain the heartless. And they do protect vulnerable people. Why am I so involved in euthanasia advocacy? Well, because I know that if you change the law to allow assisted suicide or euthanasia, then you inevitably place pressure on vulnerable people to end their lives out of fear of being a burden upon others. You steer them towards suicide. I mean people who have mental health problems, who are elderly, with dementia, or with disabilities. That is exactly what we see in the jurisdictions that have closed to UC. So law is there. One of its purposes is to restrain the heartless and stop exploitation and abuse. People say you can't legislate morality. But actually every law legislates one morality or another. Which morality is it going to be? That's the question. And if we're not involved, then others will be with different agendas. Now, there are others, of course, who say, you know, we should be doing social service but not social justice. Now, of course, what I mean by that, you know, reaching out to people, meeting their needs, and absolutely. We should as a church be doing this, absolutely. And our churches, they should be running soup kitchens and doing debt counseling and street pastoring and mothers and toddlers groups and crisis pregnancy counseling and providing food for the poor and so on. But we also have to address the structural injustices in society that lead to many of these inequalities. There are those who say, you know, you'll just antagonize people rather than commending the gospel. And of course we will. There'll be some people who are very angry with us. When we won this vote on the Isle of Guernsey last week, there were some very, very angry people who could do nothing but take to social media, the internet and Twitter, and voice their anger and concern. And if we're not upsetting some people, then we're not standing for truth that's under attack. There are people who say, well, we don't have a right to oppose immorality. You've probably heard this. But it is not our morality. It's the morality of the God of the universe. And I'd suggest also, it's not about rights either. It's more that we have a duty in a democratic society to do what we can to ensure that the laws on the statute books are just and fair. Wilberforce was only able to stop slavery because initially he made the slave trade illegal. And that could only be done by an act of parliament. And no amount of kindness and charity to slaves would change that. It needed social justice as well as social actions. There's some who say we shouldn't restrict people's freedoms, but of course every law restricts freedom to some extent. That's why we have laws. We have laws because we believe autonomy and freedom is not absolute. We're not entitled to exercise freedoms that undermine the freedoms of others. And then there are those who say, you know, we should be known for what we are for, not for what we're against. We've got to be more positive. Well, I'm sorry, but when I look at the Bible, I tell the Lord telling us to do some things and not to do others. And the way to freedom is through both of those things. We've got to be for some things and against others. And I think if we're not preaching the whole truth. So this is my prayer, that God will raise up a new generation of people like Wilberforce, who are generous philanthropists, who are passionate about the peculiar doctrines of the Reformed faith, who are passionate about world mission, who are passionate about injustice, who are passionate about the Lord Jesus Christ, and who walk in his footsteps. And carrying the cross in this generation, I think, means on the one hand expending the power and energy we have to minister to the needs of the broken, but it also means being willing to stand up as a prophetic people and call a nation to account and to take the suffering that will inevitably follow that. And of course, you know, there are some people saying we must preach Jesus, it's all about Jesus, and of course it is. But when the Apostle Paul talked about his work, he said a little bit more than that. He didn't talk just about preaching Jesus. He talked about preaching Jesus as Lord of the whole universe and ourselves as his servants walking in his footsteps. And we're not under the illusion that we will bring heaven on earth, but we can be a witness to that kingdom that God will bring through the return of Christ. So thank you very much.